Welcome to another Cinematech podcast. I'm Scott Kirzner, and I'm here with Chuck Tryon from Fayetteville State University. His new book is called Reinventing Cinema, Movies in the Age of Media Convergence. And Chuck also writes the blog called the, I don't know how you pronounce it, the Chutri Experiment?
Chutri, actually.
The Chutri Experiment rhymes with chutney, which you can easily find by Googling it, C-H-U-T-R-Y. So Chuck, thanks for making time to chat.
Thanks for hosting me.
Just first question, I'd love to know kind of the most favorite movie of all time and movie that you've seen most recently, and maybe, you know, how you saw that movie, you know, if it was in a theater or on an iPod or something like that.
Well, the most recent movie I happened to see last night was the documentary Betrayal by Ellen Kuras. And I happened to see that because of my blog, PBS's POV series, has been sending me screeners for their upcoming documentaries. So just in this case, it happened to be on DVD. I have been watching more movies recently, probably on Hulu and other similar web distribution sites. One of the other most recent ones I saw was Google Me, the documentary by Jim Colleen, where he vanity Googled himself and found, you know, five or six other Jim Colleens who are willing to appear in a documentary. And
and is that on Hulu?
What's that?
Is that one on Hulu?
I think that one's on, it was on Matt Dentler's site. I blogged it just the other day, but I can't remember specifically. It was one of those where I think it was just on for a weekend for free to kind of build buzz, and then the goal was to get reviews and things, and people would then go and buy it on iTunes. I know it's available on iTunes now. So,
yeah,
but
it's interesting. I mean, in it's funny. You get me thinking that in the world of cinemas, you know, like I can remember, like so long ago, like what movie theater did I see Star Wars in, you know, in 1978 probably. And
on
the internet, it's like, what site was that on?
Where
did I stream that?
Right. I mean, there's so many different venues and avenues. And of course, most of the time you're probably watching it either in a coffee house or in your office or, you know, someplace familiar.
Right,
so
particularly
that the
remarkable.
Site itself is not as memorable perhaps as
Yeah, it doesn't grab all of your senses in the way that being in a movie theater does.
Right, right.
And so favorite movie of all time?
Favorite movie of all time is probably Sans Soleil by Chris Marker. That's the one that I always first think about. And I think at the time I was just really fascinated by the way that Marker was experimenting with different narrative devices and with the kind of concept of time travel as he uses it in this kind of experimental documentary hybrid film. It's just something that I fell in love with when I was in grad school and always come back to it, it seems.
So I've really been enjoying the book, and one thing I wanted to ask, you know, you talk a little bit about movie reviews and in a way, you know, what I think you could characterize as sort of the decline of movie reviewing in print, you know, whether it's magazines or newspapers, and the rise of movie reviewing on the internet. Do you feel like, and it's funny because I think I hear from a lot of studio executives and even people making, you know, independent art house films that, you know, they kind of bemoan the decline of print reviewers and maybe don't understand some of the positive things about online kind of blog-based reviewers. And I also think that they kind of sometimes think that blog-based reviewers are really only of the Ain't It Cool News variety, where the only movies they care about are like the latest Wolverine movie. But what's your take? I mean, give us your read on kind of the, you know, the decline of print and the rise of the blog in movie criticism.
Well, I think there are probably some big challenges because, I mean, it really is hard for any single film blogger to match the outreach of something like even the Atlanta Journal-Constitution or the Raleigh News Observer, which might have hundreds of thousands or even millions of readers, versus individual blogs that I think are maybe a little harder to locate. So I think I understand at least part of their ambivalence about some of these changes. But in terms of questions of credibility, I mean, certainly many of the film bloggers that I read and many of the people who review films have either advanced degrees in film studies or maybe even work in the industry in some capacity. So they certainly have the training or the background to review films in very eloquent ways. So, I mean, I think there are thousands of reviewers out there who are, maybe not thousands, but hundreds of reviewers out there who are doing really interesting, challenging, compelling work. And I think one of the big problems now is kind of learning how to filter that out and find reviewers that might have some kind of authority. And I think that's one of the challenges is when you look at or look for pull quotes to draw from. I mean, people will have heard of Roger Ebert or someone of that caliber, but they haven't heard of Chuck Tryon of the Chutry Experiment in most cases. So, I can see how.
But I mean, maybe we're moving towards a world where, like, if I resonate with your movie reviews, you know, I have an RSS feed and I make sure that I read all of your reviews, and I might be the only person in the world that resonates with your reviews, but I'm glad that you exist. And I would almost posit that maybe what's happening in the blog world is that when you aggregate all those reviews and you say, okay, The Girlfriend Experience, to pick a recent movie, got on average 2.5 stars. That's the information that's going to matter, and maybe not one individual critic like a Pauline Kael or a Roger Ebert. I'm just throwing it out there for you to react to.
Right. No, I think that, I mean, I've read similar studies, and there are a couple of companies that have been making that argument recently that a lot of people who are looking for, you know, the typical Friday night multiplex experience or even the typical art house movie might just look and see, okay, did it get 7 or 8 a user rating from other IMDb members, or
Rotten Tomatoes,
or
I mean, I even think about, you know, an art house experience I had in DC recently, where I wound up going to see Goodbye Solo, you know, great movie, based on, you know, some kind of aggregate rating that showed up on my iPhone, you know, when I was using MovieFlix or some little iPhone app that is really a Showtime app, but had that aggregate review. And, you know, I don't know, it didn't matter to me that there was no individual critic that was telling me to go see that movie.
Right. I mean, I think what will happen is the audiences themselves will adjust, will find new barometers for making decisions on what movies they see. And I think that's one of the things that, you know, blogs, they're definitely adaptable to that. So I don't think that it's something that will make it difficult for marketing purposes. I mean, I do think that there may be something that gets lost when we don't have kind of these distinct voices that everybody's hearing. I mean, there is also some kind of pleasure, I think, in the reading the different reviews from the 60s, the kind of, as you said, the Pauline Kaels and others who had so many
movement.
Interesting things to say about movies. Yeah.
Right, and individual filmmakers and kind of named things and labeled things in great ways. I totally agree. So next question I want to move on to is, in the book you kind of say you don't see movie studios going away, that studios are going to remain powerful as you kind of envision what happens next in cinema.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's still going to be some attraction to these big blockbusters, and certainly, I mean, we can look at something like Transformers or the Spider-Man series or some of these others that, the Batman series, where, you know, there's hundreds of millions of dollars at stake, and, you know, I think the studios are probably better positioned to, one, acquire the properties and license out the different, you know, either comic books or video games or whatever. And so I think studios will exist in some form for the foreseeable future. I mean, I can't see too distantly, of course. But, I think there will always be varying distribution models, but I think one of those will be kind of a studio type of model that will trade in, especially the high concept kind of comic book or other kind of large property films.
And you talk a lot in the book about various indie filmmakers, though, who are sort of experimenting with, you know, non-studio, non-traditionally financed, non-traditionally distributed models. You know, among them, you know, Aaron Crumley and Susan Bice with Four-Eyed Monsters. And I think you talk a little bit about Lance Wyler and, you know, even going back to his first movie, The Last Broadcast. I mean, you seem to see some potential there, but I also wonder, you know, you touch on the question of, are there just going to be so many movies that get made, you know, given the democratization of filmmaking tools and technologies and the democratization of distribution and marketing tools and technologies. I mean, is there just a conundrum there in terms of, you know, yes, you can avoid the studio system and make your own way in the world, but so can everybody else?
Right. I mean, I think to some extent, you know, that challenge is going to be a difficult one to surmount. I mean, given that anyone can go and spend a couple $100s for a camcorder at Walmart or Target or something like that and get editing software for their computer and put together a decent little movie, you know, that certainly democratizes the ability to produce. And, you know, I think part of it is, I mean, learning from people like Lance Wyler, Aaron Crumley, Susan Bice, and others who have created really interesting models for marketing and promoting their films. And certainly not every film is going to succeed, and that we see that with studios as well as with indies. You know, so I think what's probably going to happen is, at least to some extent, there are going to be a lot of filmmakers who continue to have day jobs, whether that's something in the industry or some, you know, some other field completely. But, you know, I think one of the things that I find most exciting among the things that I find most interesting are the ways in which filmmakers like Susan Bice and Aaron Crumley, for example, created the podcasts to really create awareness of Four-Eyed Monsters and create this kind of ongoing storyline that's almost more like a TV series, kind of following their experiences in order to get people more invested in their film. And I think that there is some interesting creativity that's actually taking place in that kind of promotional arena that's really exciting and really worth thinking about and worth watching.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because you did get me thinking a little bit about, you know, has there ever been a time when you could be sort of a filmmaker avocationally? You know, like your day job might be at, you know, Barnes & Noble or, you know, a consulting firm, and, you know, your job after six is filmmaker. I'm not sure that we've had that in the culture before.
In film, I'm sure there are some avant-garde filmmakers who probably had appointments with universities and part of their employment was maybe making films, but also teaching filmmaking. But, you know, I think the barriers to production in the past have been so high that probably would have been a lot harder. I mean, certainly, you know, in the 50s and 60s, you might have somebody like Cassavetes who would act to pay the bills and then go off and make movies independently. But that's, you know, I think that's relatively rare compared to what we have now, and mm-hmm. especially in terms of some people actually being able to do it to some extent professionally and to gain at least some sense of a wider audience.
Yeah, yeah. I guess the last thing I want to touch on was just, I don't know if it's an explicit idea in the book, but it definitely felt like it's present there. But when I was at an event last year at UC Berkeley, I was doing an interview on stage with Ted Hope, you know, the indie film producer, now blogger. And you know, he kind of brought up this idea of like films never being finished, and that, you know, you're kind of releasing content and sharing with people what the film is about and trying to get them engaged before the film is quote-unquote released. Then the film is released and, you know, there's the content of the film itself and probably some other marketing and bonus material around that. And, you know, and then you are maybe doing other versions, alternate versions of the film at some point and maybe continuing to release kind of marketing behind the scenes, director's commentary type material, you know, after the theatrical release, before the DVD release and before the download release. And, you know, that really the only, you know, potentially going forward, the only time a film is going to be done is when the filmmaker decides, I'm not working on that anymore. And even then, potentially the audience could decide that they're not done and still be kind of remixing and commenting on and, you know, maybe making their own versions of the film. And, you know, I just would love to get, as a last thing, you know, kind of your thoughts on that.
I actually really like that idea, and I like how both you and Ted Hope have spelled that out, because I think that that captures something really interesting about film, and rather, yeah, as you said, rather than seeing it as kind of a complete, discrete object, the film is kind of networking with these other things. There are all these various versions of it, and even, you know, like the completely at home, do-it-yourself, completely amateur versions of Doctor Who movies, or
there was one of actually of Indiana Jones. I don't know if you remember that story of like the kids who made their own videotape version of the shot-for-shot remake of
and
the first.
They did it over several years, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
so that, like, kids' voices were changing and
right
as the characters evolved, and so, you know, these movies, and this is, I think, always been true to a certain extent of stories, develop a life of their own, and people want to reinterpret them, update them. I mean, you can see that with the fake trailers and the kind of updates of The Shining, for example, and things like that. But yeah, I think, you know, especially if you think about things like documentary or films that people are really passionate about, seeing it as an ongoing story, as something that's continuing to evolve, I think is really valuable. And certainly the director and the creative people involved will move on to other projects, but just kind of having that there as a way of updating the film. And I think of examples like Hoop Dreams. They've done two or three updates, like Where Are They Now? Is about the two main characters, William Gates and Arthur Agee, because
I didn't know that.
Their stories were so compelling that we wanted to kind of revisit them. And so there, you know, there are a number of cases like that, and I think that the kind of inexpensive nature of digital cinema and the production technologies involved, distribution technologies involved, even if the filmmakers just wanted to post something on Vimeo or Hulu or something like that, you know, it's relatively cheap to do that, and people will be able to find it and continue to talk about or think about the ideas presented in the film. So I think that's, I like Ted Hope's formulation of that. And it resonates, I should give credit to Nicholas Roams for the concept of incompleteness that I use to kind of advance my thinking on those concepts.
And I guess just one very last thing I wanted to touch on is that, you know, it kind of came up in your answer to that question is, you know, it's not like you ever something, it takes a long time for one thing to die or one way of doing things to die and another thing to completely replace it. But it does feel like there's this pendulum shift of kind of giving up control and inviting the audience in and asking people to collaborate in new ways. And, you know, I talk a little bit about that in my recent book, Fans, Friends, and Followers, but I feel like so many established filmmakers have trouble with that idea that they're going to have to give up some control and think about ways to invite the audience into the film rather than just say, here's my product, go see it.
Right. You know, I think that that's, you know, based on the kind of classic notions of spectatorship or audience that are based on the, you know, that are caught up in the a group of strangers sitting alone in a darkened room with a projection image. And you know, we're, as we've discussed, seeing movies in so many different contexts, so many different frameworks now that, you know, we do find ourselves kind of reimagining how we can become involved. And so I think that's, you know, I think that's a really interesting challenge. And, you know, there are certainly some filmmakers who will probably refuse that. But, you know, I think there are tremendous opportunities for thinking about how to get audiences excited, or audience is the wrong term, how to get people excited about your project and maybe even involved in promoting and producing it. And I think that's from Fans, Friends, and Followers. I mean, I think that's one of the things that I was really interested in, is how a small core of people can really make a difference in terms of pushing that conversation along.
Great. Well, I really enjoyed chatting with you, and you know, again, congratulations on the book, Reinventing Cinema.